Welcome to the CSUN podcast for 2020. In this episode, we'll be looking back at the podcast that we recorded in 2019, and we'll attempt to look ahead for the rest of the year 2020. My name is Mark McKenzie, a senior financial sector specialist in the Financial Stability and Supervision and Payment and Settlement System workstream. With me today is Dr. Ole Rommel, Geraldine, and Aziz. Geraldine, would you like to introduce yourself for us, please?
Thanks, Mark. A warm hello to all our listeners out there, and pleasure being here nestled in the company of three fine gentlemen. My name is Geraldine, and I am the CSUN Center Senior Analyst in charge of developing and delivering content in the leadership and governance areas.
Hi everyone and Happy New Year. My name is Aziz Durrani. I'm a colleague of Mark's. I also work in the Financial Stability, Supervision and Payment and Settlement Systems pillar. And very happy to be here reviewing what we discussed over the last year and also looking ahead to some of the interesting and emerging topics in 2020.
And as Mark said, my name is Ole, and I work in the macroeconomic and monetary policy management area of the CSUN Center. Now, one of the reasons we have this fine cast of characters here today is, and I think this is the first time we have assembled that many people on one of our podcasts, so this will be a first for us. One of the reasons is that even though we may all hail from different areas or different pillars of the CSUN Center, a lot of what we do actually overlaps to a certain extent. So even though, you know, I may consider myself a macroeconomist, monetary policy affects financial stability. Financial stability has an effect on monetary policy. We'll talk in a little while about other issues such as central bank design, governance, leadership, which of course then influences policy and vice versa. So it's what is interesting are the interactions between our different pillars, and I hope to be able to come back to this in a minute. Thank you for joining us and for listening. As always, our aim is to share information on current topical issues related to the CSUN Center's three core pillars. One of our ambitions is to be a thought leader for central banks and monetary authorities in the Southeast, in Southeast Asia and the Pacific region. In case you're interested, or you're listening in for the first time, you can find us on SoundCloud at CSUN Podcast, and you can also follow us on Twitter with the hashtag at CSUN Center, and on YouTube, and our email is podcast@csun.org, in case you have any questions and comments.
Okay, thank you very much, Ole. So in 2019, we recorded 8 podcasts, and we cover a range of subjects and topics that are of interest to our stakeholders. The subjects also demonstrate how the three pillars within the CSUN Center interact with each other. Some of the topics we covered in 2019 included the evolution of central banking and inflation targeting, cybersecurity, which is a big concern for the financial system these days, culture and misconduct in banks. We looked at issues such as risk relating to fintech, cryptocurrency, and the blockchain world. We look at also at the issue of non-performing loans in the banking systems, as well as issues relating to commercial real estate and leadership, which Geraldine will cover in a little while. Ole, we had some delightful guests last year as well.
Indeed, and it's we're very proud about the fact that we can attract some excellent speakers and resource persons, including, for example, Mr. Grant Spencer, who is a former Deputy Governor for Financial Stability and then Acting Governor of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. We also were very fortunate to be able to talk to Jessica Chu, who is a deputy governor for financial stability at Bank Negara Malaysia. We had a very interesting podcast with Mr. Stephen Scott and Mr. Jeff Kupfer of Starling Trust Sciences. If you don't know Starling, they are a behavioral sciences company that utilizes technology to assist in the evaluation of culture of organizations, including banks and other financial institutions. I spent some time with both Stephen and Jeff while they were here, and I had to be very careful about how I behave. I always felt that they were examining me about my own behavior. We spoke to Malik Katadia, who's the co-founder and chairman of the Finnovation Lab. Mr. Philip Stedman, who is the CEO of Snewcode and a managing director of Stedman and Denny, Philip was previously a senior technical specialist at the Bank of England. We talked to Mr. Findlay McPherson, who is the former head of commercial real estate responsible for Asia Pacific at HSBC, and also a former senior technical specialist from the Bank of England. And finally, we talked to Dr. Hans Genberg, who, as you may know, is our former executive director at the CSUN Center and currently professor of finance at the Asia School of Business, where he has just finished, him and his colleagues have created a master's in central banking course, which will go live in June of this year. Most of our podcasts do not exist in isolation. Many of the podcasts or the contents, subjects and topics covered in the podcast actually made it into our CSUN courses and other events. And this will continue in 2020 as well. And this has been a very useful way for us to think about the issues and then think about them in a bit more depth in our courses and other events.
Yeah. So what we'd like to do for the rest of the time that we have, about 20 to 30 minutes, is to look back at some of these recordings that we did last year and to highlight in most of them two or three key takeaways, as well as we try to look ahead and for the rest of 2020 as well. So, Ali, would you like to kick us off in terms of the conversation that Dr. Hans had with Mr. Grant Spencer on evolution of central banking and inflation targeting? What were some of your key takeaways from that session?
Yeah, thank you, Mark, for that. One of the interesting things for me in terms of that particular podcast is, so Grant Spencer has been a lifelong central banker. So he spent all of his career at the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, and obviously over that time he's seen a number of changes in that particular institution. Now he didn't start there in the 1970s, but he did mention the institution back in the 1970s when it was classified as being extremely paternalistic. Now, thankfully, since then, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand has become a much more open and modern institution, very collegial, and just like in many other countries, a highly respected institution inside the country, which prides itself on promoting the competition of ideas. So this got me thinking a lot about conduct and the organization of a central bank or the behavior of staff within the central bank. And we were also fortunate for our executive committee meeting to have we will put the name in McConnell, Meg McConnell from the New York Fed, who was heading the critical thinking function at the New York Fed. And again, this sort of illustrates how far central banks have come in terms of welcoming, fostering critical thinking, which, you know, is the sort of the antithesis of a paternalistic institution where what the boss says goes, and now critical thinking is welcome. But we also had a chance to talk about the institution becoming more tolerant, more transparent, more open, and which I'd like to discuss with my colleague Geraldine, who's obviously in terms of leadership and governance, whether this sort of chimes in with what you do and the courses you offer.
Thank you, Ole. I must agree that these are the burning issues of the day, and we have infused these facets in our leadership programs. In fact, all leadership and governance gurus will tell you it's time, the time is right to talk about diversity and inclusiveness issues, and we have rightly included these aspects in our programs.
Excellent, excellent. So, Aziz, if you can chime in here. I think technology is one of the things that is driving some of the changes taking place in central banking and the banking system. And you had a chance to speak with Malik on fintech and some of those changes.
Yeah, so Malik was actually here to come and speak at the CSUN's policy summit on cyber risk in June 2019. And I took some time out to catch up with him. And he's actually quite an interesting character. He spent most of his career at Citibank and other institutions working in kind of banking and payments related areas. And then he set up this Finnovation Labs, which basically helps new startups in Singapore and across Asia, either with getting more funding or linking them in with banks and helping develop their business models. But Malik is also, he's always on the circuit speaking at various fintech conferences and so on. So he's quite clued in to what's happening at the moment, and it was quite an interesting conversation to see, you know, how much things are developing, have developed, all the new technologies that are coming in, and we talk about these all the time in terms of, you know, how banks can now do a credit assessment very quickly online. You just need to take a selfie with your passport and that can be done almost straight away and linked into various databases. But also some of the dangers this poses in terms of fraud and other kind of things. So how can we get past that? And then some of the opportunities that new technology also brings for us as central banks and regulators and how that can make some of our work a little more efficient, which I thought was quite interesting. Of course, we also touched on Facebook and Libra and the introduction of their new so-called cryptocurrency. I won't go into all that now. I have a blog on that if anyone's interested, but there are a number of issues with that, and we've seen more recently a lot of pushback from regulators and central banks against how it would operate, and a number of their partners are also kind of pulling out. But I wouldn't bet against Facebook because they do have a multi-billion dollar budget, so let's see what happens. And I think we've all seen central banks themselves now coming out with their own thoughts on issuing digital currency and so on. So
I found it very interesting that in contrast to sort of earlier cryptocurrencies, where central banks seem to be rather unfazed, governments seem to be rather unfazed by cryptocurrencies, the Ripples, the Bitcoins, the Ethers of this world. When Libra was announced, there was an immediate response by governments and regulators, sort of within the day or a day later, sort of saying that this shouldn't be allowed or this poses great risks. So I found, you know, the sort of difference between 10 years, the difference between in approach between 10 years ago and now, I found that very incisive and very interesting. I also came across a particular piece that said that central banks really aren't interested in issuing their own cryptocurrencies. So they all pretend that they are just about to issue a cryptocurrency in order to prompt the private sector. The underlying issue here is, as I believe, and I hope my colleagues agree with me, is the inefficiency of cross-border payments. And Now, whether this is necessarily solved by a cryptocurrency such as Libra remains to be seen, but there are many more things that can be done by existing firms using existing technology to facilitate, to enhance the efficiency of cross-border payments. So I'd like to believe that this sort of thought that a lot of central banks are sort of prompting the private sector to do this, instead of them having to do it, because there are all sorts of problems, sorts of issues associated with a central bank issuing its own cryptocurrency.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, just in the year that since we've had that debate, we've now got GrabPay here in Asia, and it's become, you know, everyone's using it now to pay for their food, when you go into a supermarket or shop or whatever. So. I think people are getting into this digital wallet, and once it makes life easier for you, it's very easy to get roped into it. And that's where I think that the power of Libra can potentially be, if it works in that way.
But as I listen to the conversation, I think what is coming out to me is the issue is change, and change requires leadership. So we're going to ask Geraldine to chime in a little while, but there are two things that I want to for us to zero in on. One of the conversations we had last year was with DG Jessica, and that was on cyber security, cyber risk. And that was the lead up to the policy summit that Aziz mentioned earlier. Now, from that conversation, there are a couple of things I took away from that conversation. One was the importance of governance for cyber risk, again, pointing to leadership. The other was around ensuring that both the central bank as well as the banking institution have the required tools and, critically important, skills. All right, and the second bit that I want to mention is what Ali just mentioned on cross-border payments, because what we want to let our audience know is that we don't do these things in isolation. So a program that we have in 2020 is on cross-border payments and the impact of technology. So we're trying to answer these questions. So Geraldine, tell us a little bit about the podcast that you were involved with and a little bit more on this issue of change and leadership in central banking.
Thanks, Mark. Let me begin by highlighting that the CSEN Step Up to Lead podcast was launched in October 2019.
Yes.
The key remit is to garner insights from exemplary leaders, not only from the CSEN community, but also from outside the grouping, including the private sector. It offers an opportunity for central bank staff of all levels to learn from other leaders, particularly the what, why, and how of their leadership skills. You talked about skills, so here's the opportunity to learn from others their skills and experience in developing as high-performing leaders. So the inaugural dialogue was held with Dr. Hans Gernberg, as you correctly mentioned, a former executive director of the CSEN Center, whose term ran for 4 years until the end of June 2019. For me personally, this was a stimulating conversation with an individual who I will label as grounded in his leadership philosophy, as well as in executing that philosophy. Hans has had an illustrious career covering various organizations, and his leadership journey has been peppered with many distinct moments. If I perceived him correctly, Mark, that in trying to lead people, he has also profoundly discovered himself, both his strengths and shortcomings. He alludes to the need to be deeply in tune with oneself, that self-reflection is pivotal so one gains an honest awareness of oneself and how one's behavior as a leader impacts others. So in a lot of the programs that we are delivering for 2020, we are including this component of emotional intelligence. We see that it is very instrumental for our central banking courses. Hans also makes no bones between leadership for one's Western interest and leadership for building and growing talent, the latter being the pathway he deduces that all leaders must work hard at carving out. He was candid that he had never attended any leadership programs and merely based his leadership actions on what came naturally to him. Some of the key takeaways for me were that they covered showing empathy, giving people opportunities to shine, being fair, listening deeply, and remaining open, inclusive, and receptive to ideas. In summary, my impression is that Hans finds a sense of wonder in the everyday and inspires us to rise in the morning and feel privileged that no matter the job we handle, we can make some positive difference on this planet. And Mark, let me end this segment by saying that I am zestfully looking forward to delivering several leadership podcasts this year. So listeners, do keep your ears peeled.
All right. So as we listen to Geraldine and the attributes that she highlighted from her conversation with Hans, and the even Hans' own self-growth, and we think about the changes currently taking place in the banking sector and in central banking, as well as the impact of technology, liberalism, how critical are these attributes to helping to confront some of what we're seeing today? I don't know, Aziz.
I think they're incredibly important because you need to be able to motivate people, inspire them, and lead them. The big problem I think we have, as particularly as central banks and regulators, is the, and we're just talking about the new technology that's coming through, the people with the specialism in these areas are very much in demand across the financial sector, private banks, consultancies, startups, and so on. And the real challenge is how do we, as central banks and so on, attract and keep these people and keep the right talents and so on. And often it comes down to money because we can't compete with that level. So it makes it even more important in some ways to offer other opportunities, development opportunities and so on, to try and get these people in and the right training at the right times and so on. So that's always a concern.
I think we will throw that question again to Geraldine and Ole. I think when we spoke with DG Jessica, we had this conversation on skills. And what I found interesting in terms of that conversation was we have to rethink some of how we acquire the skills. So for example, through internship programs, we have to think about things like how do we align ourselves, well, not just us as central bankers, but even the banks themselves, align themselves with universities. We have to think on the issue of cybersecurity, for example. Do we look to people in the military, to the defense? So we have to rethink how we get some of these skill sets. But if you can chime in, Ole, on the question as to the attributes from the conversation that Geraldine had with Hans, how critical do you think those attributes are as central banking evolve or take on these new technology?
Thank you, Mark. I was actually thinking about that for a timely reason that both Aziz and I used to work at the Bank of England. And if I understand correctly, I mean, tomorrow will be Mark Carney's last day on the job. And there was an ad in the paper for, his position was publicly advertised. And when I read the ad, it was kind of implying that only supermen or superwomen should apply for this particular position, because you have to know about everything. You have to know about monetary policy. You have to know about financial stability. You have to know about payment systems. You have to know about leadership. You have to know about governance. You have to know about banknote printing and all of these things. So just in terms of the skills required by a single person, just in terms of having a good picture or having an idea of what's going on, I think makes sort of marks a big change from what what we had before. And I think this was also sort of a theme of one of our, a theme of not only our podcast, but also what we did last year and what we are continuing to do this year in terms of the demands on a central banker these days. So I think I'm going back to this paternalistic world that Grant Spencer talked about in the 70s and 80s, where central banking was really simple and a central banker had one job to do, which is to keep inflation low and stable. For whatever reason, which we can hopefully pick up in a later podcast, central banks have been lumbered with many more tasks in the meantime. Some of them justifiably, though, other maybe not, with sort of more sort of dubious provenance. We do now know that there's an interrelationship between monetary policy and the banking sector. It behooves us to strive for financial stability in all its forms. But increasingly, you know, there's talk about central banks doing something about inequality, or central banks doing something about climate change. And we have a very active program in place that looks at whether this is a justified claim, whether this makes sense, and if so, how central banks can respond to these added dimensions, which I'm sure if you talk to a central banker back in the 1970s would have never given a second thought to the idea that a central bank should do something about climate change.
So there's a lot for us to talk about, right?
I mean, this is something I've been mulling about. How stretched should a central bank be? What sort of governance arrangements should be in place to allow the central bank to do all of these? Are there limits to what a central bank can do? Mm-hmm. Any thoughts?
Mm-hmm. I go ahead, Aziz.
Well, I was going to say, at the same time you have all this, we are having this whole debate around, you know, what is the current mandate of the central bank, and actually, is it having, you know, is it going to have the effect it has now that interest rates are more or less at the bottom, almost zero or even negative? What real power do they have to make a difference? And so we're having, you know, we're seeing these reviews now at the Bank of England to see should central banking be changed in any material way. It's also interesting at the People's Bank of China, they've just announced a new way of how they're going to be setting the lending rate, and so there's a lot of thinking going around, you know, how those things could change. But you're right in asking how will the governance process around that work, and how can you have someone with the knowledge across all those areas effectively operating? So
and on top of that, I agree with Aziz, but on top of that, we have sort of issues like, you know, does a central bank still have the firepower should another financial crisis occur? What's worrying me much more is the constant attack on the independence of the central bank, with sort of politicians muscling in, trying to, at best, influence the central bank policies, at worst, telling the central bank what to do, and some central bank actually following what the president or the head of the country, and I'm not talking about the obvious president, but another country, following what the leader does. So there's lots to talk about this year on this topic in terms of preserving central bank independence, which I think of the many things we do know, this is sort of, I think, the one thing that actually that holds true for a central bank, that the central bank should be independent.
All right. So there's a lot for us to talk about: change, innovation,
culture.
There's a lot to talk about, but there is still the bread and butter bit, Aziz, and you had a conversation with some of your guests about things like non-performing loans,
yes,
things like commercial real estate. Mm-hmm. These are things that we still have to worry about. So what were some of the key takeaways from some of those sessions that you had?
Yeah, Mark, you're right. There's all these exciting things such as digital currencies and climate change and so on. But yeah, we still have the bread and butter issue. So one of the podcasts we did was with Phil Stedman. And Phil has had a long background in kind of emerging markets debt structuring. He was at Merrill Lynch and then moved to Barclays and then was also at Renaissance Capital covering African markets. And he gave, we were also actually very lucky to have him speak at one of our courses as well. So he was really teaching us about how to ascertain corporate loan transactions when you're going into a bank, what kind of things to look for, and in particular identifying the non-performing portfolios or characteristics which could indicate non-performance but which may not have been marked as such by the bank. And then the really difficult bit is how to then challenge bank senior management and get them to accept that there's an issue there. And really what came out of that is, you know, within the central banks, within regulators, we need people with expertise who have some background in doing loan reviews, understanding transactions, so that when they challenge the bank, they can actually pick up files and point to issues and have that debate. Otherwise, it's very hard as a generalist supervisor to get into some of those debates. So that was interesting. The other podcasts we had was with Finlay McPherson. And Finlay also has had a long banking career. He started off at Royal Bank of Scotland, then moved to Standard Chartered, and then joined the Bank of England as a technical specialist. And then again, when he left there, he then joined HSBC, heading up their commercial real estate practice. So, you know, commercial real estate really makes the bread and butter of what a lot of banks across the world, and particularly in Asia, do. It forms a large part of their portfolios, and many of the conglomerates here have large exposures to that. And it's also the, you know, investment in commercial real estate and the property market, as we saw from the recent financial crisis, also has led to a number of bank failures. So Finlay was really drawing out some of those lessons, how to assess loan exposures, how to look at development finance, how to look at exposures that have been built and the security behind them. And then he also talked more broadly about risk-based supervision, Basel III and the new IFRS 9 regime and so on. So again, if you want more details on that, please do go back and look at those podcasts, because I think there's a lot of interesting learning coming out of that. And just a reminder that we still need to carry on focusing on some of these issues.
I hope our quick tour through our podcast last year whetted your appetite for more. We obviously can't do justice to all of them in their entirety, but hopefully you can see the sort of the breadth of topics that we look at the CSUN Center. So please, if you're interested, have a listen to our podcast last year. Now let me gaze ahead a little bit to the rest of 2020. So at the CSUN Center, we will continue to host more CSUN podcasts. In fact, let me briefly advertise the first one of this year, which is already available online. So the title was Big Tech in the Financial Sector: More Choice for the Consumer, More Challenge for the Regulator. And I think that sort of pretty much encapsulates how I would think about this issue. We did have a real expert on this come and visit us. And Mark and our colleague Len Taski spoke with a prolific writer and educator, Professor Douglas Arner, who is a professor in law at the Asian Institute of International Financial Law at the University of Hong Kong. And we had a fascinating conversation about the entry of big tech, by which we understand companies such as Facebook, Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Alibaba, and Tencent, and the like, into the provision of financial services, i.e. lending, payments, and even exotic cross-border instruments such as stablecoins. So the question we discussed with Doug is, what are the benefits of these big players bring to the table, and what are the risks of allowing firms that are already dominant in their market to potentially dominate banking as well? So I'd like to invite my colleagues just to give sort of share their own thoughts, brief thoughts on those two questions.
Absolutely, I'll jump in. I think one of the key points from our conversation with Doug Arner in early January was that these new big tech firms will bring enormous benefits, efficiencies, but they also present some enormous challenges as well. Certainly, one is with respect to competition, whether or not they will crowd out other players from coming in, issues with how to deal with data, issue around privacy as well. There's issues as well with respect to concentration. So those are some of the key points we got from the conversation with Doug Arner as well.
And I think in particular, given these concerns, what should central banks and regulators be doing? Because we're now going to be needing to expand the net to cover some of these players. And if they're holding data, you know, who controls that? Where is it held? Under whose jurisdiction? And do we then start going into these companies to look at their data and investigate them as well? Particularly as they've stepped up and Amazon now lends to its customers. Grab is also lending to its drivers and so on. They're looking at insurance products as well. So it's all coming under the kind of regulatory framework, but not officially in there yet. So I think those are interesting areas.
I mean, in terms of data, I mean, some of the topics that prompted me to think more about this is, if this data or if these data are available, should central banks have access to it? And if so, should that be available for free, or will these companies charge us for using that data? I mean, another topic I kind of worry about is the using these data in terms of, I can envisage a world where these companies, in providing loans, are able to finely differentiate between different customers and sort of basically offer tailor-made loans, and I think there's a potential for not really market abuse, but for sort of abusing these big tech lenders knowing who is a financially sophisticated borrower and who is a financially illiterate or sort of less educated borrower, and changing a much higher interest rate for the that is already happening, but tailoring contract in such a way that it's not immediately obvious to a less financially literate person what they're getting themselves into. Those are some of my thoughts on this.
It works on the insurance side as well, because once you have all that data, you can give very cheap insurance to the low risk, but then you know who are the high risk, who have the medical conditions, and suddenly they're out of the market or can't be priced in. So there's a whole area about financial inclusion and that whole part of society that's going to suffer as well as the ones that will benefit.
Excellent. I think we're trying to position ourselves as thought leaders around some of these subjects and some of these topics. And what is interesting is some of the points that we just mentioned are actually already highlighted in some of the programs that we have planned for 2020, if I think as is about the pillar that we work in within the financial stability and supervision, as well as the payment and settlement stream. For example, we have a session later this year on fintech regulations, where we're hoping we will be touching on issues with respect to the big tech firms. We have a program coming up later this year as well on ICT risk management, including cybersecurity, where we will touch on the issues with privacy and data as well. And we have...
supervisory technology.
Yeah, because Ole just mentioned whether or not supervisors should have access to some of this. So we're going to talk about things like RegTech and SupTech as well. And Geraldine, you have some excellent programs lined up in the leadership stream as well.
Well, like I mentioned, these will touch on the burning issues where driving talent is concerned. So we have on strategic human capital, it will encompass talent acquisition and retention of a multi-generational workforce, leadership masterclass one on leading with emotional intelligence, a springboard program for mid-level managers on leading teams, a leadership masterclass two on secure-based leadership, and the Central Bank Governance Seminar will focus on culture and ethics.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm very excited about some of the our work streams. On top of my mind is a research project that we are undertaking on capital flows and capital flows management measures. This again touches on a number of issues. Again, going back to the very first podcast with Grant Spencer, in terms of monetary policy and central bank operations, in the sense that for the longest time, capital controls were a big no-no in international finance. They were generally generally regarded with disdain, and any country using capital controls wasn't really a pariah, but wasn't particularly popular in the eyes of some of the large international institutions. Now, our research project this year is trying to not really change that, but is trying to work out what an appropriate policy toolkit for a modern central bank should be. In the sense that central banking has changed a lot, and the tools available to a central bank have changed a lot. So it's not only the control over the interest rate; it's also intervention in foreign exchange markets. It's the availability of micro and macro prudential policy tools, i.e., the regulation of individual banks and the regulation of the financial sector as a whole. And finally, there is the possibility of what we now call capital flow management measures rather than capital controls. I was quite surprised in 2012 when the IMF changed its minds on capital controls. One of the big constants in macroeconomics was that capital controls are bad, but the IMF changing its mind on capital controls. So the idea is, how can we put all of these four things, these four policy tools, together in a meaningful and efficient way? So our capital flows project is meant to address this in a regional context, i.e. What is the optimal policy toolkit using those four measures. Other than that, I'm quite excited about the fact that we'll be offering 9 courses, of which 5 are either brand new or substantially revised. So we have really refreshed our course offering this year, including one, surprise, surprise, on capital flows management and capital account liberalization.
Yeah, so thank you very much, esteemed colleagues and friends. So let's wrap this up. As we look forward to 2020, what is it that you're most looking forward to? What do you see ahead for us? You know, in a minute, Geraldine.
I think we're CSEN Center programs are concerned in the areas of leadership and governance. I like to see more robust discussions at our programs, more robust peer-to-peer exchanges. I like to see the central banks sending very suitable participants so we get into those discussions and that we derive deeper insights that will inform our research and programs for the future.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think 2020 is going to be a difficult year, and I think come back to what Ole was saying earlier, is have we reached the limits of what central banks can do? And there, you know, there's a crisis brewing. It might already be on us. It might be coming sooner than we expect. So what are the tools that are going to be available, and how are we going to deal with that is kind of a big concern. And then also we have issues around climate change, climate risk. You know, to what extent should central banks and regulators be getting involved in, and what are the practical areas they can get involved in? And obviously, as we're speaking, we have the coronavirus spreading across the region. We don't know how bad it's going to be, but it's going to be a real test for all these institutions in terms of how we react, what's it going to do to global growth levels, you know, it remains to be seen how we react to that.
Yeah. So if I think about it from a financial stability perspective, I think, unlike 2008, I think with the regulatory reforms that have taken place over the last couple of years, in some respects, and if we think about within our CSAN membership space, there's some high points. Banks, for example, are much better capitalized. So that's a good point. It doesn't mean that there isn't undercurrent. In terms of regional cooperation, international cooperation, those are well in effect. There's a history of using macroprudential policies as well. So we have some things, some strengths going in, but there's an undercurrent when we speak about the issues with respect to health, which is we are experiencing now. There's issues around protectionist policies, political stabilities as well. So Ole, what are you most looking forward to in 2020?
I would go for a combination of what Javelin said and what you two guys said. So one, I'm always very much looking forward to our courses because I really like the exchange of views, however limited they may be, and on some occasions. But there's always something I can learn. There's always something new that I need to think about, and that sort of surprises me, and that is something that I never thought about with my background from Europe and the Bank of England and so on. And so that's always something I look forward to. I think I'm also quite worried. Probably not quite as sanguine as you are, Mark. I'm more in the sort of Aziz camp. I think we saw big steps towards deregulation again, successful steps towards deregulation. I am astounded by how quickly people forget. It was only 10-12 years ago, which is not really all that much given the history of mankind, or how quickly people either choose to forget or how quickly people tend to forget. And what seems to be acceptable now in terms of the financial behavior of banks, behavior of households, and so on, really astounds me as well. But that being said, you know, our bread and butter stuff is being a thought leader, and it may not be probably not all that fun, but sort of, you know, things like Libra appearing from one day to the next and forcing us to think about it a very short time horizon. So that's certainly sort of something that I always find very, very challenging, but also very, very enjoyable. And bringing home this research project on capital flows. So there's a lot on our respective tables.
Yeah, we at the CSAN Center, we are fit for the challenge, isn't it? We talk about deregulation, and we haven't even touched on the attack on central bank independence. So we continue for 2020 to hit the current topics, the core issues, and try to do as Geraldine said, have much deep conversation around these topics. Thank you very much for listening to the CSense podcast. If you like our content, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcast or on Stitcher if you're listening on Android. Thank you very much.